Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. We're on BitChute at Talk Digital Network. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. The stock markets had a bit of a bounce at the end of the week, but will that continue? He looks at the U.S. dollar and strongly hints silver will make a comeback. Veteran BC trader Victor Adair gives us his opinion on whether the greenback will continue its climb upwards, the headwinds Europe is facing, and whether crude will start climbing again. Publisher of the RealEstateTiming.com newsletter, Robert Campbell, tells us about what's happening in the U.S. real estate market, especially California, and the ongoing exodus from that state. Plus, at the end of the show, we'll have a company showcase update from American Manganese Doing Business as Recyclical Battery Materials CTO, Zarko Maselgia. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on Twitter at ChartsByRoss. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Good to be with you, Jim.
How did the stock markets perform this week?
Well, this is a bit of a reversal out here, not only just in the stock markets, but in a lot of the indices that we would look at as well. The extremes that we like to look for things in terms of either momentum or in sentiment that would suggest that there's a reversal in the works. And what we've had in this last week to 10 days has been pretty extreme. The AAII, the American Association of Investors, had the bullish percent number down under 25%. The bearish numbers are extremes as well. And when it comes to the action in the puts and the calls and the options, the institutions at this point bought three times as many puts as they did back in 2008. So the panic has been in place now as far as the not just the public but the institutional accounts are concerned. And of note, what we had was the important low in the market about a month ago. We've had this decent bounce, and now we've had a 62% retracement of that rally. And the fact that we have got a more bearish outlook out there and a more concerned one when we're actually making a higher low, that's indicative of exactly what we've seen around a lot of the I'll call them interim or major lows in terms of the stock markets in the last couple of decades here. So the upside reversal that we've seen at the tail end of the week, right on Friday, has probably got a fair amount as far as the potential on the upside. Would not be surprised, though, that it eventually falters and that we have a second wave of selling that takes out the lows. But I think before that sell-off, we get a pretty darn good rally here.
What's happening with the U.S. dollar?
Well, this is all part of the equation as well. U.S. dollar index, a nice high. It's been just rallying very strong. It got up through 110. Got a reversal at the end of the week here. That's also part of the same equation. All these items, pretty much, you're going to be able to throw a dart and say that this week ending September the 9th is looking like a pretty good reversal all around. So as far as the dollar index is concerned, hit 110-ish. I think support is probably in the 104 to 106. Wouldn't be at all surprised that it gets back down there and tests that during this clean-out phase right now.
Now, the Canadian dollar, is it holding its own against the U.S. dollar while other currencies are not?
If we look at the Canadian dollar, it managed to put in a lower low this week, but just like everything else, it's been stepping down and getting a bounce at the end of the week here. I think it probably somewhere up around that 76-cent mark becomes pretty good overhead resistance. Still having trouble staying with any buoyancy because of what we've been seeing in the crude oil market. Oil had a pretty rough week and then closed up a little bit at the end of the week, but the pressure over in the oil market is keeping Canada under pressure. The as far as the energy markets are concerned, one of the biggest potentials out there right now is in natural gas. And we typically, on the seasonal, you would see a low in gas prices, usually the latter part of August into the middle of September. I like to see it get down with an oversold reading on the RSI, also get down into the moving average band that we run on it. And that has happened this week. We've had a nice sell-off down into 8 on the nat gas. And I think you, if anything, that is probably one of the better trades here on the commodity side coming out of the low right now. The other one that really attracts attention here is the fact that silver, we have a net long position by the commercials, and there's about 5,000 contracts is the net long position between the longs and shorts. And in the last 30 years, we've only seen that now. This will be the third time, and the previous two instances saw 20% rallies as far as the price was concerned. And with this one, the silver being down as low as it is right now and sitting for a reversal, that looks like a pretty good trade as well.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
More than welcome, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on Twitter at chartsbyross. Coming up, Victor Adair next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Victor Adair, recently retired from nearly 50 years of being in the brokerage business in BC, but he's still very active in the markets. He's speaking to us from Parksville, a beautiful town on the seacoast on Vancouver Island. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Well, thanks, Jim. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Victor, the stock market has struggled since we talked last month. It seems bad news is everywhere as central banks raise interest rates and energy prices are going through the roof in Europe. What are your thoughts on all this?
Well, let's frame it this way. I thought the last couple of weeks of August, as is traditionally the case, trading volumes get a little thin. You know, a lot of people are on vacation. As we used to say on the floors, you know, the adults have left the building. It's just the kids, you know, that are on the trading desks. And oftentimes, when we come back after Labor Day, we kind of come back with a bang as things maybe that got a little out of line in August get straightened out. Or, as I've been expecting here this year, some of the trends that we were seeing in late August would get reversed. And that's kind of what's happened, whether it's the stock market or the commodity market or the currency market. But just to stay with your question here about the stock market, you know, we had the put perspective on things. The major American stock indices hit all-time highs at the very first week of this year, back in January. And that capped, you know, just a tremendous run that we've had, let's say going all the way back to 2009, the recovery from the great financial crisis, but certainly since the lows, the depths that we got into following COVID panic back in March of 2020. And not only had prices gone up, but, you know, everybody and his dog, it seemed, thought it was easy pickings to make money in the stock market, and we saw a lot of, let's say, poor investments that were made. And I think really we saw the Nasdaq peaked out maybe in November of last year and started down, the Dow, the S&P, the Vanguard Total Market Index, and that sort of thing, the broad indices, didn't turn lower until January. But we started down, and we've had, you know, since January, prices have gone lower and then rallied a bit and then gone lower and rallied a bit. So we made an important low in the middle of June, and that was leading up to that low. I think the Dow Jones fell, forgive me, but this will be approximate, about 3,000 points in seven trading days. As the market was, let's say, trying to factor in the prospect of the Federal Reserve after years of sort of being so easy, you know, they would throw money at the market anytime there was any problem at all. The Federal Reserve seemed determined to get tough. And at the middle of June, the central bank, the Fed, raised rates by 0.75 points. But not only that, they basically brought out the big stick and said, listen, there's a lot more to come. And so markets were getting prepared for that kind of bad news by the Dow falling 3,000 points in 7 days, and we made an important low, and then markets rallied from middle of June till the middle of August. And that rally, certainly as it got into the early part of August, I was characterizing that, or thinking about it anyway, as a bear market rally. That, you know, that the problems hadn't been resolved, inflation was still strong, the Federal Reserve and other central banks were going to keep pushing interest rates higher. You know, China was in the tank for any number of reasons, Europe was in the tank for, you know, reasons. You know, there wasn't a pretty picture out there. There was a lot of bad news. Well, in the middle of August, the markets turned lower. As I say, we're in that holiday period, we're just the kids on the trading desk, and markets traded down. And my thought was that we would turn higher as we came into the period after Labor Day. And so far, that's what's happened on the stock market.
You've been bullish on the U.S. dollar in every interview we've done since January of last year. The U.S. dollar has rallied to 20-year highs. Are you still really bullish on the greenback?
Well, you know, this time, Jim, I'm going to change my mind. Yes, I have been bullish the U.S. dollar. It had hit an important low the first week of 2021. And that was it actually the day that we had the Capitol building in Washington stormed, you know, by Trump supporters. And I think the world was aghast, you know, to see this happening. But it's kind of the old line from, you know, the Rothschilds, you want to buy when there's blood in the streets. And that's a metaphor. I'm not so much saying physical blood in the streets, but, you know, it was just an awful scare, let's say, that was happening. And since then, the U.S. dollar has rallied a lot. Other currencies have fallen a lot, particularly the euro currency, the Japanese yen, but with just across the board, basically, the U.S. dollar has been strong. Now, the strength of the U.S. dollar really started to accelerate here, well, let's say in the last 9 months or so, certainly this year. And the basis for that acceleration was the market's view that the central bank in the United States was going to be tougher than other central banks, that the interest rate premium in America would be growing over other currencies. And this is one of my favorite sayings for the past 45 years, about the currency markets, capital comes to America for opportunity and for safety. So when, you know, markets are, when the bad news is out there, you know, where you want to be is in the U.S. dollar rather than other currencies. Now, I know there's folks that think the U.S. dollar 10 of the currencies aren't worth the paper they're printed on, and, you know, I'm not going to disagree with that necessarily. But when we're trading currencies, it's one against the other, and the U.S. dollar has been the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry basket. Okay, that's that old cliche. However, I hope you could feel that coming. The U.S. dollar hit a 20-year high this week, this post-Labor Day, and I think we might have hit an inflection point. Now, it's clearly too early to say. We won't really know until, you know, a month or two has gone by. I don't think it's going to just pivot and go to zero. I'm not talking that way. But it's had such a run. And lately, the run has been not only on the interest rate premiums, but it's like everywhere else is a disaster compared to the USA. And that, I think, has, we've just seen, for instance, the Japanese yen is down about 22% this year. I mean, for Canadians listening, if a Canadian dollar was down 22% since where we were in January, we'd be at about 60 cents instead of, call it, 76 cents. You know, so just to give some perspective, it's just been an incredible fall. And Europe, you know, there's been almost like no relief, at whether it's the euro currency or the British pound or any of the other peripheral European currencies, say, other than the Swiss franc, which is always kind of special. But I think we got to a point here where there was so much negativity in the market and so much going to the U.S. dollar that we might have hit an inflection point. And at least from a short-term trading perspective, that's why I'm trading the currency market.
The central banks have been raising interest rates to bring down inflation. Are they going to keep raising rates? And will inflation fall?
Well, that really is the $64 trillion question. I think to answer the first part of that, yes, they will continue to raise interest rates. The central banks, I think, were slow. Other people would say they were asleep at the wheel, but, you know, let's just, no point being rude. The central banks were slow to realize that inflation was surging, you know, that famous word transitory. That's what they thought the first blip up in inflation a year ago or so was all about. And then it turned out that that wasn't the case. We've seen inflation not only continue higher, but it kept getting higher. And I think the central banks have decided that it's their job to do whatever they can to squash inflation. Now, some of the folks that said they were slow to get going are now saying that they're going to overcook the goose, as it were, that they're going to raise interest rates right into a recession, and, you know, then they're going to have to unwind interest rates. You know, lots of folks want to point the finger at other people and say, you know, they made a mistake. But the second part of your question about, you know, they're going to keep raising rates, will inflation fall? And that's the key, because that's what's got them raising rates in the first place. You know, I think a good part of the inflation, let's call it broad market inflation as opposed to asset inflation, like the stock market going up, has been created by a lot of money that was printed. You know, governments set out with their fiscal plans to help people get through the COVID period. Central banks kept interest rates really low, so there was an easy fiscal and monetary policy here following the COVID panic, and that helped create inflation. There was also, however, supply issues, you know, and when people say you can't print electricity, you can't print copper, you know, you can't print natural gas or coal or wheat or any of this other sort of thing, that they can't. The central banks don't have much ability to do anything on the supply side. They've got this blunt tool of trying to kill the demand side on the for commodities and supply issues like that by raising interest rates. So that's what they're trying to do. Will inflation fall? Will we? You know, there will be certainly some demand destruction. Some folks say there will be too much, and, you know, we'll overdo it. I've been inclined to think that inflation is going to be stickier than what the market is believing and maybe what the Fed's believing. However, we are seeing the forward market pricing in inflation, kind of like we've hit the high for inflation, and it's going to be trending lower over the next year or two. Whether it gets all the way back to the 2% level that the central bank seemed to want it at, I rather doubt. But I think when we're going to come up next week, we'll have the CPI figure Tuesday in the United States. That'll be a closely watched number. It's probably going to tick a little lower than it was in July. This will be the August number, get released next week, simply because gasoline prices have fallen so much. There'll be other components in there as well. So a lot of this is going to be psychology on and expectations about what may or may not happen. But I think the banks will continue to raise interest rates. They're kind of going to stick to their guns. I think inflation will fall some. Whether or not it falls as much as they want will determine whether or not they keep raising rates.
Crude oil prices jumped to 14-year highs after Russia invaded Ukraine in February. Natural gas prices and electricity prices in Europe have soared. California has rolling blackouts. What are your thoughts on the energy markets?
Well, let's again put a little historical perspective on it. I think if you were to look at a chart of crude oil prices just as a surrogate for energy prices broadly, you'd see that between 2015 and 2020, we may have had crude oil or energy prices too low. You know, I think we were below $60 as an average for that period of time for WTI. Now, what happens when something is cheap? You know, people kind of maybe take it for granted or spend too much of it or use too much of it. Or, you know, and people go out and buy some god-awful gas-guzzling vehicle instead of, let's say, you know, a little compact car, which what you might do if gasoline prices were really high. So just broadly speaking, it may be that we had a 5 or 6 year period there where energy prices were too low. Certainly during that period of time is when the Germans in particular, but let's say the Europeans generally, thought it was just going to be okay to become very dependent upon Russia for energy supplies, natural gas and crude oil. Perhaps, you know, if they had a chance to do it over again, knowing what they know now, they wouldn't have done it, but they did. So we got into this predicament, let's say, where around the world, the demand for energy was growing, emerging markets becoming more prosperous, and having a demand for things like air conditioning and gasoline, where maybe previously they didn't. So just as the population grew and the world became more advanced, the almost inexorable rise in the demand for energy. Compound that with the whole ESG movement that said certain forms of energy, and let's say broadly speaking fossil fuels, and everything from, you know, coal to nat gas was wrong, and we got to stop using that, so there's going to be no serious capex on developing supplies. And also a trend from from individuals to institutional money to avoid investing in the, call it, the dirty side of the energy space, and everybody fell in love with windmills and solar and so on. And also nuclear was deemed kind of evil. So now we've got this incredible shock where after thinking that energy was going to be readily available and cheap, it's not. So my thoughts here are the market perhaps overreacted in terms of, let's say, freaking out. We've seen absolutely bizarre increases in prices of electricity, for instance, and that gas in Europe. And with good reason, there's fear as to whether or not there will be rationing, and that'll mean the economy slows down. Businesses have to shut up shop because they haven't got the energy to do what they need to do, and so on and so on. I think it's going to be a pretty wicked, volatile market. I've seen the open interest, the number of people who are willing to take a position home at the end of the day in the futures markets for all kinds of energy products has just tumbled because of the volatility. It's scary. You know, you lose your house by betting the wrong way. So it'll be a volatile market. I think it's going to be the key market because energy prices seep through to everything. It'll be the key market in determining whether or not the inflation that we talked about earlier does get back to the levels that the central banks would like to see it at. I don't have the crystal ball. You know, I've said so many times I make my money from managing risk, not having a great crystal ball. And, you know, personally, for my own trading, I'd be very careful about trading energy market from either the long side or the short side.
You've been trading future markets since the mid-70s. You were a commodity and stock broker for most of the past 45 years, but you've been trading only your own accounts for the last couple of years. Can you give us an insight on how you develop trading ideas and manage trading risks?
Let me do it this way. I mean, I read a lot. I mean, I get at my desk here usually by 5 in the morning, and it's a full shift and take some time off in the afternoon. And a lot of my time at my desk is reading. I subscribe to a lot of services. I access a lot of other services. I've certainly got screens up here that show me what's going on in a lot of markets. So I will form some opinions about what's going on. I'll form some opinions about what the sentiment is in the market. Like I was talking earlier, when sentiment gets really strong one way or the other, like in the U.S. dollar, it got really strong. The longer the trend goes on, you know, then it just keeps going and everybody wants to be long. So we get to a point where maybe a market gets out of balance in terms of sentiment. So I pay attention to things like that. I'll form opinions as to what I think will happen in the market, just from the reading I do. And then I go to my charts. If I had an opinion that I thought a market was going to go up, I don't just go buy it. I need to find out whether this is a good time to buy it, where to buy it, how much risk to take on the trade, and so on. So let's say for instance, this week, I had this notion that the U.S. dollar had probably gone too far. So I'm thinking, how do I play that? Well, I want to be short the U.S. dollar. I could, and what I have done is I bought the Canadian dollar. I bought the Mexican peso. I bought gold. And those markets had been beaten up because the U.S. dollar had been so strong. The Canadian dollar, I've noticed, marches very much in harmony with the relative strength or weakness of the U.S. dollar, but also pays a lot of attention to the S&P 500, which is a barometer of risk, and I had a feeling that the stock market was probably going to do a little better. So if I think the U.S. dollar is going to weaken and the stock market is going to rally, buying the Canadian dollar seems like a good idea. So then I look for a spot to buy the Canadian dollar, and that's where I look at my charts and say, okay, I think, you know, if it breaks through such and such a level here to the upside, I'm more confident that this is a good time to buy it. But on the managing risk side, if I buy it here, then where do I know I'm wrong? At what point, if it starts to fall, how much, you know, room am I going to give it, as it were, to go against me before I cry uncle and say, you know, I got to preserve my capital? So with trading, for me, the most important thing is I got to protect my capital. So that means I don't go crazy with sizing. You know, I know it's going up, so I'm going to bet the house. Never. I want to find a good spot to buy something where I think, okay, this looks like a good pattern on the chart. I like that. So I'm willing to buy it. And I'll know before I get into the market where I'll get out of it if I'm wrong. If I'm right, I don't know. You know, I might end up thinking, I was going to get into the trade for a couple of days, and if the market's going my way, you know, 2 months later, I might still be in the trade. Terrific. You know, I got to keep looking at it fresh every day and see, does it make sense to be long? Go, yeah, okay, well, we'll stay long. Something else that I do, and I think this is also really important, is when I'm looking at my charts, I will look at several different time frames. Now, I've said on these interviews before that it's very important to keep the time frame of my analysis in sync with the time frame of my trading, but I'll look at different charts. For instance, a weekly chart's going to look different than a daily chart. a daily chart's going to look different than an hourly chart and so on. But if I see something that's starting to look good, and however I think whatever good means, but if I see something that's looking good in more than one time frame, that enhances my my willingness to put some money at risk and buy that market.
Victor, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Jim, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I enjoy it, and I look forward to talking with you again.
My guest has been Victor Adair. His website, victoradair.ca. We now slide down from Vancouver Island to San Diego to speak to Robert Campbell next on This Week in Money.
Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Robert Campbell, author of Timing the Real Estate Market and the Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter online at realestatetiming.com. He's speaking to us from San Diego. Bob, welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thank you, Jim.
Bob, when's the next Campbell Real Estate Timing Letter coming out?
I'm finishing it right now. I'm almost finished with it, ready to take it to the printers, and so it's the timing of this interview on Howe Street probably couldn't be better because all these statistics are fresh in my mind, and what's coming is going to I believe it's going to shock a lot of people.
You have an upcoming speaking engagement. Where is it? When is it?
It is. I have a seminar at the La Jolla Marriott on September 17th, and the title of it is How I Stop Worrying and Learn to Love Inflation.
A little salute to Dr. Strangelove.
What was the name of that? How I Stop Worrying and Learn to Love the Bomb? Was that it?
That's exactly right.
That was a great movie, by the way.
It was one of the best. Are you updating your book, Timing the Real Estate Market?
It's the book was published in 2002, and right now I am working on my second book. The first book hasn't changed a bit, and that I update the charts in that on a consistent basis. I believe I'm on the fifth edition in 21 years, but the second book is going to be about everything else I've learned about real estate timing and real estate markets that can help you make more informed decisions in the last 21 years. And I'll tell you, it's going to be as good as the first book.
What's the latest on the Treasury yield spread?
Well, it's still negative. I mean, if you look at I haven't checked it in, the last week or so, but like the 2-year is still still higher than the 10-year, and I think that the 2-year is higher than the 30-year or close to it, so it's still inverted. But even the fact that it's still inverted, everybody, that really doesn't matter that much. Once the curve inverts, and that inversion occurred in the last 6 months, or maybe even a little bit longer, that's all it takes. Because once it inverts and even it goes back to uninverts, the die's been set and a recession's coming, and that's what that indicator continues to tell us, that a recession is coming. Of course, technically we're already in a recession. We've had two negative quarters of negative GDP. By the definition of the National Bureau of Real Economic Research, that's a recession. So we are in a recession, even though nobody wants to admit it.
Is the U.S. dollar the market to watch?
Well, whether it's the market to watch, it's a market to watch. And the U.S. dollar is likely to continue to get stronger and stronger and stronger And it's only because that we're the prettiest of the three ugly sisters, but that the money that's flowing out of Europe right now, which is a real basket case, it's flowing to the U.S., where it's likely to be treated better. You know, the euro's crashing, so it's going into the dollar, and that's what's feeding the dollar strength. So, you know, people don't want euros. So if you don't want euros, what do? You convert your euros to dollars. And the more and more people do that, if people continue to do that, the euro goes down and the dollar goes up. When will that reverse? I don't know. I mean, but the euro's in a death spiral right now.
Is continuing inflation good for some markets and not others?
Absolutely. It absolutely is. And that's what my seminar is about. You want to be in the right asset class at the right time. And if you study what happened during the 70s and other previous inflationary episodes, some asset classes do better than others, you know, by a wide margin. And what's going to excel this time is commodities. You go back 100 years, and you've seen three distinct commodity cycles, which tend to last decades, you know, not just years. But, you know, even going back to the 1920s, and then going back to the 1970s, and then what's happening now, commodities have never been cheaper relative to the S&P 500 than they are today. And what that means, and that's how you get ahead in life, everybody. You buy assets that are cheap and then have big upside potential. So that's, you know, I'm showing other indicators that are showing, you know, how commodities have done during inflationary periods, and they've outshone everything else. So the place you want your money right now is, you know, relative to other assets. The best performing asset groups in the next, you know, probably 10 years is going to be commodities and gold.
Is the passing of the Inflation Reduction Act, where the printing presses will be in high gear, likely to benefit the stock markets?
No, it's not going to benefit the stock market, because what it's going to do is it's going to feed inflation, because that Inflation Reduction Act isn't being funded by increase in taxpayer tax receipts. It's totally being funded by an increase in the debt. So what it's going to do, that the Treasury is going to create more Treasury bonds. You know, to add to the national debt, which in the U.S., which currently sits at $31 trillion, and the Federal Reserve is going to print money to pay for those Treasury notes, Treasury bonds, and it's going to give it to the government to spend. And like all governments, you know, giving the government a dollar to spend means that at best maybe 50 cents, you know, goes into the right hands. And the other 50% either gets wasted or into the back pockets of politicians.
What do you think the real rate of inflation could be when food and energy are factored in?
Well, right now the rate of inflation, as the government reports it, which is understated, everybody knows that, is 8.5% here in the U.S. And I would say, based on, you know, as long as I've been around and what I see prices are doing, you could easily add 3 to 4% to that number. So, you know, 8.5, add 3, 11.5%. Maybe even more importantly is this, that that inflation number is measuring an entire basket of goods, everything. That's something like 40 or 100 different commodities. Everybody doesn't buy every commodity. Things that are higher than that rate are the cost of medical care, the cost of college tuition, the cost of food, and things like that. The rental housing is more than that. So another thing that what the average consumer needs and purchases in everyday life, the rate of inflation is greater than 8.5%. You know, we don't all go out and buy a new flat screen TV every year, which keep going down in price. So just forget about that part. So you look at food, you look at energy, you look at rent. That's way above 8.5%.
Another thing, Bob, they don't include in the cost of living is rising taxes.
Yep. Nope. Sure don't. And I'll tell you guys that I'm on Medicare. I mean, it's Social Security and Medicare, because I'm above 65 years old. Last year they raised our cost of living index for those things. It went up 5.9%, I believe. Out of that, the government subtracts, you know, takes out of it automatically Medicare Part B, and I have supplemental insurance, of course, you know, because you're. And then I have prescription insurance that if you go for that, that all gets deducted out of your 5.9% increase in your Social Security benefit. Net, after they took out all those medical costs, I believe my Social Security payment went up $100 a month. So it's a joke, you know, $100 a month. You know, you can't even go. That's not even going to take care of one trip to the supermarket. So it's one of the things that's really out of control is medical costs, and that's where Medicare is expected to run out of money by anywhere between 2024 and 2025, and that's when things are really going to get scary.
This week, the Bank of Canada raised its bank rate by 0.75% to 3.25%. The Fed's next meeting is September 21st. What do you think they're going to do to your trend-setting rate?
I think they're going to follow suit. I don't think they can. I don't think they have any other choice, really. Until the pain gets so bad that they throw in the towel and let inflation run wild. But the inflation is so high, it's devastating people right now, Jim. Devastating. I mean, my gas and electric bill in the last 3 months has gone up 20%. 20%. I know people in Europe would probably kill for that kind of a low rate increase. But the average American, that's a huge percentage increase in just 3 months. And I've read that the one out of six Americans is behind on their utility bills. They can't afford to pay it. So you just keep letting inflation run wild like this without cranking up interest rates to slow down demand, you know, you're going to have, you think you've got a problem now? Wait till you see that. There'll be food riots. People won't even be able to afford to live. And that's what's probably happening in Europe right now. I understand England, their inflation rate is over 10. And their utility bills this winter are supposed to double or triple. So Europe's in really bad shape on all this stuff. So, but it's here in the U.S. too. And what's so interesting about this is that once you have inflation going up like this, where you got to pay for the essentials, food, rent, and energy, what that means is that people are not going to be able to go out and afford a new $1,400 cell phone. They're not going to be able to go out and eat as often with their friends. They're not going to be able to go to Starbucks to pay $7 for a cappuccino. And so there you have it. And that's why high inflationary periods, and if you look at during the past, anything over 5% in the United States, when inflation's reached that on a year-over-year basis, it has always resulted in a recession every single time, not one exception. So we're going into recession. There's no, I mean, we're already in it, but we're going headlong into it. It's going to get worse. And now we're going to see, and the same kind of dynamics work for the Canadian economy as do the U.S. And now we're going to see the resolve of these central banks. Are they going to keep raising rates and help the common man and bring down inflation? Or are they going to give in to the rich people and support their assets and start lowering rates again and let inflation run wild? I mean, those are two bad choices. So this is going to be really interesting. But as I see it right now, you know, the last report from the Fed, they said they have no choice. They said there's going to be pain. We're going to raise interest rates. And so I expect them to raise just like the Bank of Canada. Europe even raised, my God, you know. I mean, their inflation is 8% or so, and their Fed funds rate is like still close to zero. They're so far behind the curve that it's amazing. They're the most far, but that was real encouraging to see what Canada did. It takes cojones to do that, guys, but sometimes you got to do what's right to save your currency, save the people, and so that and the central banks created this monster themselves, so they have nobody to blame but themselves. They let interest rates go ultra low for a super long period of time, which inflated asset prices. You know, if you can afford a $100,000 house at 6% mortgage rate, and all of a sudden you drop mortgage rates down to 3%, now you can afford a $200,000 house because the payment's the same. I'm just using that as an example. So what happens when you drive interest rates back up to 6 where they belong or higher, you know, to kill inflation? Your $200,000 mortgage falls back to $100,000. So that just take that 100 grand out of the price of a home. In fact, here in the United States, interest rates, mortgage rates, have risen 103% in the last 12 months. 103%. They've risen from 2.86 to 5.86 in September. And based on my analysis of charts and chart patterns, that rate is definitely going higher. The mortgage payments have increased by 43% in the last 12 months. So that is totally undermining, you know, housing markets. It's undermining the stock market. And the longer and longer the Fed has to raise interest rates, it's also going to undermine the stock market. And I don't say that because it's just a feeling I have. Just go back and study charts. See what happens when the Fed raises rates, over a period of 50 years. What happens to stocks? They go down. What happens to real estate? It goes down. So what's been fueling these asset bubbles that we've seen over the course of the last 20, 30 years have been lower and lower and lower interest rates. And we very well could be the era of cheap money could be over, and it could be over because that inflation's going to make it be over. You just can't drop interest rates back down, bring mortgage rates back down to below 3%. You know, try to re-energize the housing market and let inflation go off at double digits or 10%, 15%, 20%, wherever it wants to go. It's just going to devastate people. It's going to devastate the economy.
What's the latest on real estate in the U.S. and especially California?
Interestingly, we're at a point right now where I'm almost at a coin flip, whether to call this a top or whether it might last another month or two, and I'm leaning toward calling it a top because all the trends are negative. Everything that supports rising housing prices, like rising demand for existing home sales, declining inventory, lower interest rates, lower mortgage defaults, all those things are working are unfriendly toward housing prices right now. So I think this is it, guys. I think that this is it for this cycle, and I expect the U.S. housing prices to go down on an inflation-adjusted basis by about 40 to 45%, and I expect California housing prices to go down by 45 to 50%. And that could happen in a variety of ways, guys. I mean, that even just on a nominal basis, which means prices aren't adjusted for inflation, if California housing prices fall by 15% nominally over the course of the next, 3 or 4 or 5 years, 15%. Okay, if inflation's going off at 10 and housing prices are falling by 15, at 10 times 3 for inflation is 30, add 30% to that. So you go, oh yeah, my house only went down from a million, to 850,000. Uh-huh. So after you sold your house for 850,000, what did it buy? It bought it bought 30% less than it did, you know, 4 years ago. So there's your minus 45%.
California has rolling blackouts, mass illegal immigration, growing tent cities, and laws that favor criminals. Is real estate likely to price this in at some point?
That's a great question. California also has the best climate in the world. So that must be the only thing that's holding this thing up. But you're right. At some point, crime just starts taking over, where people don't want to live here anymore. The exodus out of California is very real. So if that trend continues, yes, it will impact housing prices, and it could impact them. You know, that's something that hasn't even been factored in. I have no way of factoring in because I don't know what degree that people are going to leave the state to go somewhere else. But I'll tell you, people are leaving the state. I think something like, you know, 75,000 people left the state of California last year. And where are they going? They're going to Arizona, they're going to Florida, and they're going to Texas. Are people from those three states, you know, relocating to California? No, they're not. So that could be a big deal, too.
Looking ahead, could there be opportunity to buy heavily discounted California real estate with the hope that the governments at the city and state levels will change?
Oh, well, I don't anticipate any government changing except by physical force. No, they're not, because that's not the way governments work. They will always protect their own power, you know, their own position. They will never do anything that tends to disrupt that. But I do think the housing prices are going to become way more affordable and way lower during the next 6 years. In fact, I just wrote a blog post, Making a Million My Way. And what my wife and I are going to do, we're going to buy a high-end fixer-upper at the bottom of the next cycle, which I anticipate to be around 2029, somewhere around that. And then it's going to be a fixer. We're going to rent the home we live in now out, move into it, make it our own primary residence. I'm going to do my fix-up magic to it, which I can do about 80% of the work myself. We're going to live in it and ride the cycle up. Then we're going to sell it at the peak and move back into our old home. And the profits we make on the home we just moved into, the fixer-upper, the first $500,000 is tax-free. So that's the kind of strategy that you need to look forward to or have some kind of plan on how you're going to deal with the future. So, I think there's going to be, I think unbelievable buying opportunity is going to come our way, but it's not going to come our way for at least 6 years. I know that's not what people want to hear. They go, oh boy, prices are down. There must be a lot of opportunity. No, there's not a lot of opportunity. If a house falls 10% and you can buy it at 30% under market, yeah, that's opportunity. Are those deals readily available? No. They're super, super hard to find. You know, in fact, they're almost non-existent. So what you have to do is you just have to let market forces play themselves out. Let property values fall, where the market gets fear-driven. Nobody wants real estate. They're giving it away, and that's when you want to step in and buy it. And that's where the great opportunity is. And by the way, everybody, that's where the opportunity is in commodities right now. But you go back and look at the 100-year cycles of commodities relative to the S&P 500, we've never been cheaper. So, I mean, you think about, okay, what can you expect from buying something that's never been cheaper relative to the stock market in the last 100 years? What can you expect going forward? Great things, that's what. And that's where we're going to put our money. That's where people should be having their money.
In the early 80s, when interest rates went to 20%, we didn't see debt bubbles everywhere. Could it somehow be worse this time?
Absolutely, because let's look at the 80s, let's look at the 70s, because that from 1966 through 1982, that was a long inflationary episode. Back then, the U.S. debt to GDP ratio was in the 30 to 40% range. Today, it's triple that. It's 125%. So, you know, it's a variation of the old Clinton campaign slogan. It's the debt, stupid. Yeah. Well, he said it's the economy, stupid. It's the debt, stupid. We are so deep in debt. So deep in debt. It doesn't, you know, everything is so leveraged nowadays because of the debt. It's not going to take much at all, you know, to have things come crashing down. So that's where it's going to be interesting to see how much resolve the Fed has to stopping this thing, or to, you know, they risk the economy going into a series of recessions like we did in 80-81, where GDP lost 6%. That would be devastating to this economy. But that's what it took to stop inflation, guys. There's no pussyfooting around this. You're not going to talk inflation down.
It looks like Democrat states are set to ban gasoline-powered cars. Could this affect real estate prices in those areas?
Oh, that's great. And I assume you're referring to California, of course, right?
Well... Well, didn't they announce they were going to ban the sale of gasoline-powered cars, I think, 7-8 years from now, and then 2 days later issued an alert telling people,
exactly,
please don't charge your electric cars?
They've set a time limit, but I think it's 2035, mm-hmm, that you can no longer sell or register a gas-powered car in the state of California.
Even a collector's item?
Any car. Maybe there's that kind of exception. Yeah, you want to run around in a Model T in today's model world? Go for it.
How about a 65? How about a 65 Corvette?
Oh, they'll make exceptions for that.
Yeah.
You can't stop those.
Hands but off the, my vet.
The point I'm trying to make is, you want to destroy an economy, there's no better way to do it. And it's not going to work. I mean, you know, they'll rescind that in a heartbeat. I mean, all of a sudden everybody's going to be in an EV. You won't even be able to drive out of state because all of a sudden in your EV car, because they'll only go 300 miles, and then you're going to stop at a charging station and wait in line for like 3 or 4 days to get charged to leave the state. And there's going to be, you know, none of that going on. So this is not going to work, guys. That's one of the reasons why they're trying to shut down the fossil fuel energy, go wind, go solar. And it's just not going to work. It's just a physical impossibility. That I read a report from somebody that knows this stuff, you know, a thousand times better than me. I'm not an expert on renewable energy, but they said for everybody to plug their car into an outlet in California and recharge their EV cars every day, that people that have solar panels on the house, it would take about 400 solar panels to generate enough battery power to recharge your car. 400. That's how ridiculous it is. Right now we're having rolling blackouts in California. Every day on my email, I get a frantic email from San Diego Gas and Electric saying, you know, conserve power, shut it down. We were on alert last night that we were going to have a blackout for an hour, but it never occurred. But it's coming. So I think it's going to be great. Everybody deserves what they get in life. So everybody wants EVs and, you know, no more gas-powered cars. Yeah, wait until everybody's got an EV and there's no way to charge it. It's just sitting there. So you better, I hope you're into bicycle riding, because that's what it's going to come down to. And that's why oil's going to go. That's why people think that the fossil fuel energy is going away. No way. They're going to keep shutting down production and shutting down supplies, where inventories are going to get lower and lower. Oil prices are going to go over $250 a barrel. I'm almost assured of that. And that's a commodity. That's why commodities are going to do really well. And then all of a sudden they're going to say, wow, this go green stuff was just a dream. And they say, now we need to go back to oil. We need oil. Yeah. Everything's shut down, guys. So now, you know, oil's not going to be, you know, $80 a barrel. It's going to be $280 a barrel. And commodities are just going to roar. Just going to roar.
How important is it to make your mental fitness as strong as possible to navigate these trying times?
It's the most important thing, guys. You know, mental strength is what helps you survive in this world because it helps you deal with everything that life dishes out. And you to be mentally strong, you need to be physically strong. But you just have to say, I can't be beat. I can't be beat. You can't beat me. And I've learned that more loudly and clearly in the last 2 or 3 years, because I've been reading stories about U.S. Navy SEALs. U.S. Navy SEALs that train here in San Diego, and let's say we have a hypothetical class of 100 people in it. On average, 15 to 20 people will graduate. 15 to 20 out of 100. And I tell you, if you look at that class of 100, not one of them is a girly boy. They're all like ass kickers. And why do 80% fall out? They don't have the mental strength. They don't have the mental strength to become one of the elite warriors in the world. I know that's a high standard, but I've adapted that to everything I do, where it's just like, you just never give up. You just don't give up on anything. You just fight for everything and never give up. And it works wonders, guys. It just works wonders. And I'll tell you something. People can sense that in you. When all of a sudden you develop that attitude that you can't beat me, people see it. People respect it. They see it. And it's, you know, I'm not running around, you know, with a Mossberg shotgun shooting people or anything. But I've had people tell me, they go, Bob, people can tell that you're mentally strong and that you just don't want it. You just don't want to mess with you. Even though I'm the nicest guy in the world, I'll smile at you. They just go, you know what? You don't want to screw with this guy. And it's the same with a Navy SEAL. But that's the way you're going to get ahead in life, you guys. You just can never, ever, ever give up. Because if anybody tells you that good things in life come easy, they're wrong. They come really hard. You have to fight, you know, for everything you got. And when you're up against a bigger force, you can't say, you're not going to beat me. You're not going to beat me. And it's that kind of attitude that's going to get you ahead in life. It's going to get you ahead in the markets. And it's going to get you ahead in everything. And I challenge anybody listening to me talk that read a couple books by Navy SEALs. And here's one I suggest. It goes, Can't Beat Me by David Goggins. Now, that guy's crazy, but he sets the bar so high that he is just crazy, but he says he can't be beat, and it's absolutely true. And when you start developing that attitude, people are going to, you'll see a change in people, how they respond to you. You'll notice the change. That people just, for some reason, they sense that this is not a guy that I want to screw with. I was walking down, I was downtown San Diego about 3 months ago, and I was walking back up the street to my car, and there was this homeless guy. He graduated from Harvard College, and he'd become homeless in the last 3 years because he developed a drug habit. And he was my age, and he looked pretty, I could tell he was a new homeless guy because he didn't look that bad. And I'm walking up the street, and he looked at me, never saw the guy before in my life, and he goes, there's a man with a plan. And I looked at him and said, why, thank you. And I said, I do have a plan. He goes, I know. I can tell. And I said, how can you tell? He says, I can just tell the way you walk. There's energy in your walk. You can see it in your face. And we talked for about 10 minutes, and it was the most interesting conversation. I mean, the bad part was that he had given in to a drug habit. Now he's homeless, but he was a smart guy. People can sense that, guys, and it's such a good feeling. It's such a good feeling that all of a sudden people can sense that you got it together. Because you know what? It builds your confidence. But you don't back away from anything. You go, I can overcome this.
How are things going with your fitness trainer?
Oh, they're going great. I just hired a fitness trainer, guys. I've decided to spend all my retirement money, or most of it, on health and fitness. So I hired a young kid, 21-year-old ass kicker at the gym, and we're into high-intensity interval training. And we're doing things like that what you do is that you're lifting weights and doing things, but you're doing them really fast. So you're getting your heartbeat up. And what that's allowing me to do is lose weight. My goal is to lose 5 pounds of fat in the next month or two, so I get my six-pack back again. And he's just kicking my ass, and I just love it. So we're doing things like that. I'm doing sprints. I do sprints. I sprint. I do 50-yard sprints. About twice a week, I do 10 50-yard sprints. And sprinting is a very physical, full-body exercise, guys. Does it make you strong? No. It makes you powerful. And there's a difference. You can lift weights like a weightlifter and be strong. But the way you become powerful, you sprint. Or you do these medicine ball slams. You take a 25 medicine ball, pound medicine ball and lift it over your head and then slam it into the ground as hard as you can and catch it on the rebound. Do three sets of those of 15 reps each and I'm exhausted. I have to get on my knees. I mean, but that's the kind of stuff that's the way I'm training right now. I don't want to be strong. I mean, even though I am strong, I want to be powerful. All of a sudden, you want to use your muscles in functional ways. So for the, especially you older guys out there that want to get physically fit, I would highly recommend that you consider high-intensity interval training, which is core training. Because it's, one, it's going to keep your weight down, and two, it's going to make you powerful. And you're still going to stay strong. But, you know, you're not out there to bench 400 pounds. No, you don't need to be benching 400 pounds, you know, to be powerful physically. That we just need to do things like run as hard as you can. And the reason I run as hard as I can do sprints is the lower body strength is the key to making you invincible. That's where your strength comes from, guys. And when you sprint, every muscle in your lower body comes into play, every single one. So you become really, really powerful doing that. And that's what's kind of feeding my mental attitude, too, that, you know, that I'm a badass guy.
Any health tips and wisdom for us?
Oh, sure. I mean, I just gave you all everything you need to know. I'm still taking zinc and quercetin every day. That's one of the few supplements I take. That keeps the cold away and that kind of thing. And the other health tip I'll tell you guys is this, and I've done this, is it's a secret to happiness. Get rid of people that don't belong in your life. Get rid of them. Like, if somebody's going to be a jerk, just get rid of him. I don't care if you've known him for your whole life since college. If he turns into a jerk, get rid of him, because they'll just bring you down. And so the more crappy people you can get out of your life and then fill it with people that are good, that are positive, that are doing positive things, like staying strong, eating right, you know, they have financial goals and life goals that are worthwhile. And you're still pushing. You're pushing on it till the end. But getting toxic people out of your life, I found that to be, it's something I started about 3 or 4 years ago. The difference is amazing, everybody. And you know what? There's no exceptions. If it's family, if some family member's being a jerk, he gets booted out just like somebody else. Doesn't matter. But all of a sudden, that shows the highest respect you can for yourself, for your time, for who you are. Get those people out of your life. And believe me, there's plenty of good people that are there to fill up the void.
Bob, how can people find out more about your book and newsletter?
You can go to my website, realestatetiming.com. Just like it sounds, realestatetiming.com. I have a sample issue of my timing letter. You can sign up for my timing letter. You can buy my book, which is still muy excelente, as we say here in Southern California. And you can find out more about me like that. But I just wish all you guys that are out there listening to this that I hope some of you follow up on some of the things I'm telling you, because the difference it's going to make in your life will blow your mind. It'll blow your mind. And it's all about mental attitude. You can't beat me. So buy that book by David Goggins. I think it's You Can't Beat Me, Goggins, G-O-G-G-I-N-S. And those Navy SEAL guys that graduate are just unbelievably mentally strong. Unbelievable. And you know what else? They're quiet. They don't go out blabbing around about things, you know, like, gee, I'm a tough guy and all that kind of stuff. You would never even know they were a Navy SEAL. You know, if a fight ever broke out, they would be the guys that are against the wall, not doing anything, just watching. And if anybody went over them and threw a punch at them, that would be probably one of the biggest mistakes they ever made in their life, because they'd get their ass kicked in about 10 seconds. So it's that quiet strength. You don't have to tell people. They know. They can sense it. So it's a real high, everybody, to get yourself into that area where you know you've got what it takes and that nothing is going to beat you.
Bob, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you very much. Bye.
My guest has been Robert Campbell. He was speaking to us from San Diego. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, Victor Adair, and Robert Campbell. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for our guests or the show, you can send them to info@howstreet.com. Now stand by for a company showcase update from American Manganese, doing business as Recyclical CTO, Zarco Misalgia. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen. Welcome to Company Showcase, an advertising feature on HowStreet.com.
I'm Jim Goddard. I'm speaking with Zarco Misalgia, Chief Technical Officer of American Manganese, doing business as Recyclical Battery Materials. Welcome back to Company Showcase, Zarco.
Thanks for having me.
Zarco, what's the latest there?
Well, you know, this week I really want to emphasize a few things, and, you know, especially our company business model's focus and timeline, because I do receive a lot of questions about this, and I want to make things clear for listeners on our logic behind these decisions. And I hope you'll share the same confidence as me after this. As we've mentioned before, we are focused on an integrated recycling and upcycling model. And this really looks to construct commercial plants alongside or co-locate with strategic partners. And in the lithium-ion battery supply chain. And this can include, you know, battery makers, EV OEMs, cathode manufacturers, and even lithium miners. And what is the reasoning and why do we want to do this? Well, you know, our team definitely had the foresight to see the need for recycling very early on, when recycling was not talked about much. But now it's really clear to see that there are many recycling companies entering the space, and all of them will be competing for the same pool of waste lithium-ion batteries, which will need to be recycled. And this naturally creates an increase in competition to secure supplies from waste EV batteries and battery production scrap. And you know, you need to appear like the biggest recycler. You know, therefore, you know, I've been seeing, and you'll probably see as well, lots of headline news of recycling companies building the largest commercial recycling plants, only for a few months later, another recycling company announces an even bigger plant. But to maintain this scale, I'm estimating it will require hundreds of millions of dollars and a workforce in the hundreds to manage the upfront logistics, material processing, and product sales on a projected supply of waste lithium-ion battery materials. In contrast, we're cautious and look to minimize this investment risk by preparing for commercialization with potential partners at a strategic scale, such as our demonstration plant project, which looks to de-risk scale up, and provide adequate technical due diligence for household names that have teams of people analyzing our process. And this includes multiple ongoing discussions at differing stages of advancement. You know, what if, you know, we ask ourselves the question, what if the supply is not there? Especially for these companies building these large plants. You know, a company may have secured a short-term contract with a supplier, but what if a competitor comes in and decides to offer more for the waste batteries and takes that business away from you? You'd have a large plant with no material coming in. And a great quote, which I read in a recent Bloomberg article from Hans-Erik Mellin, says, quote, nobody's really looking at each other, and they seem to think there'll be a lot of scrap and end-of-life batteries. But if you look at the level of capacity that's coming online, it's huge in relation to what we need, end quote. And in that same article, Glencore's global head of recycling is quoted saying, if you're building a standalone battery recycling business, that business is now under pressure. Some of the recycling-only business models will not succeed, or at least will be stressed because they're going to be waiting for all that scrap to arrive, end quote. And that article will be attached as well. And the article goes on to talk about supplementing feedstock in the battery recycling plant with raw materials from mine in case there is a battery shortage. To be quite honest, it's not entirely clear to me how that would work. The other thing we consider and really ask ourselves is that, you know, the battery and EV companies have more than just more waste than just batteries. But battery recycling companies are looking to source the most valuable waste. They're looking to take that most valuable waste off of their hands. So where's the rest of that material going? Is the rest of that less valuable stuff going to a waste management company? Or does that waste management company just create a all-in-one solution and take the batteries along with all the other waste that they're dealing with? I think would definitely make it easier for the supplier, but then also take away a lot of the supply from different recycling companies. But then the most important question we ask is, what if the battery makers and EV OEMs decide to recycle their waste in-house? Then nobody gets the supply. No independent or standalone recycler gets the supply of batteries because these battery makers and EV OEMs are the ones that are dictating where this material goes. And with the battery materials becoming increasingly more valuable, I believe, and I mean, really structure around our business model, is that this is the way it'll go, and that they're going to hold on to their waste. And you know, we've also been saying this for years, but there was a recent benchmark report as well that was titled "Battery Production Scrap to Be Main Source of Recycled Material This Decade." We're also going to attach this with the podcast, but in the report, they go on to say that the battery production scrap will account for 78% of the pool of recyclable materials in 2025. And I know, you know, we've really stressed for years the quantity of scrap that can be recycled. We tested scrap in our pilot plant, we tested scrap in our demonstration plant, and a lot of times we're talking, well, why aren't we doing black mass? And which we can do as well, but, you know, we're really ones front and center talking about scrap. So you can see, you know, we do think forward, quite a bit. But really putting all this market research together is keeping our team calm as we work under the radar to advance our, patented recycling technology, because we believe the companies who dictate what to do with their waste streams will be looking to integrate recycling technology in their own supply chain versus actually buying the recycled materials from a standalone company. And we are watching competitors, and I am aware of kind of what's out there, but I'm really watching them from a technology standpoint, because in an integrated model, it's really the best technology that wins out. And from what I see, I remain confident in our processor's ability for a really strong future forward.
Zarco, for people new to the company, where are you traded and how can they get more information about it?
Yeah, so we are, you know, doing business as Recyclable Battery Materials, but we are still traded on the TSXV under the ticker symbol AMY, on the OTCQB under AMYZF, and on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange under 2AM. You can find more information on our website, www.multimedia.com. as well as www.recyclable.com, and there you'll find all of our contact information.
Zarco, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Zarco Masalgia, Chief Technical Officer of American Manganese, doing business as Recyclable Battery Materials. I'm Jim Goddard. Our conversation took place September 9th.
Comments made on Company Showcase are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at HowStreet.com. Company Showcase is a production of How Street Media Incorporated.